From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. And today on the program, Your Future in Sales. Three stories about young people being let in on the art of persuasion. Beginning with this story from comic and storyteller Jackie Cation, in her house, sales was part of the basic building blocks of her upbringing. She learned all she needed to know about selling from the expert living in her house.
My father is a salesman, and he loves the pitch, he loves the sale, he loves the life. He thinks that to not take advantage of a sucker is a wasted opportunity. He sold aluminum siding, he sold toupees, he sold mausoleum crypts. My father has a full head of hair, and when he used to sell toupees, he would comb his hair like a toupee and then pretend to adjust it. He'd be like, you should get one of these. That's not going anywhere. The triumph of my father's aluminum siding career is that there is a brick house in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that has aluminum siding on it. A house made out of brick with some siding. How did he make that sale? You don't have to ask him. He'll tell you anyway. You should have heard the pitch. I just kept telling this guy, low maintenance, brick will chip. And we were like, Dad, was that fair to sell, granted, low maintenance aluminum siding to a man who owns a low maintenance brick home? And without missing a beat, he's like, fair? What am I, Santa? Am I Gandhi? Am I some kind of social worker? I got overhead, because that's what he used to call us kids. And he would never help us sell stuff for school because it's your sale. You close the deal. Well, I was 7 the first time he sent me out to work the neighborhood for Little League. I come home. He's sitting on the couch. How did it go? How did it go? How many candy bars did you sell? Was everybody home? Were there any not homes? Did you write down the not homes? You can go to the not homes tomorrow. And I didn't go to any of the houses that said no soliciting because the coach said you're not supposed to go there because those people don't want you. And he freaked out. Tomorrow, you go to the no soliciting houses. Do you know why those people got those signs up? They'll buy anything. They didn't even want those signs. When I was 10, my sister and I had a contest to see who could sell the most candles for church. You know those tall crystallized candles with the pictures of Jesus and Santa shaking hands? We were having a contest to see who could sell the most of them. And they were all over the house. And my dad had had it. He's like, are you two making any money on this? And we said, no, Dad, we're selling them for church. Now you're going to learn something. In other families, when your dad says you're going to learn something, it usually is the difference between right and wrong. In my family, it was time for a little game my dad called moral compromise. He says, how much are you selling them for? We say $3.50 each. He says, now you two are going to sell them for $5. And that's how we learned how to skim off the top. I tried to go legit when I was 11. I got my first job all by myself. It was at a place called Freshy's Pizza. Their slogan was, we make them. You bake them. And the job was to cold call pizza sales, door to door, and then go pick them up from Freshies and then deliver them back to the customer without a bike, might I add. For this, Freshies would give me 50 cents a pizza. After a week, I got an idea of how to take the business a step further. Okay, Freshies had a deal. If you bought 3, you got 1 free. So I started calling in orders for 3 pizzas and then just selling all 4 of them door to door to door to door, netting about $12. This seemed much more efficient. That would be the only job I've ever been fired from at the age of 11. In 9th grade, I was encouraged to join student government, a golden opportunity for both the school and myself to make some real money. There are 2 rules for the sale of student council candy bars. You can't sell them off campus, and they're 50 cents each. Knowing this, I was selling student council candy bars in front of 2 local department stores and at every bar in between them for $1 each. I cleared 75 bucks a week for a couple of months. But I thought I was such a great saleswoman. It never occurred to me that a 14-year-old girl in a bar selling anything to tired factory workers? Gonna be pretty successful. Here's a buck. Can I touch your arm? Yes. Pride, of course, was my downfall. I bragged about the money to a fellow student council member. She narked on me. The principal called me into his office. Now, I was selling more candy bars than anyone else, and I was making money. I thought he would be proud of me. So when he confronted me, I confessed. He was shocked. He said, "I'm going to have to tell your parents." And I tell him they know, and he looks at me like I had been raised by wolves and sneers, "They know." So like any wild animal trapped, I turned on him and I said, "What do you care? You're getting your cut." But I remember walking home from school. It felt crazy to be afraid of getting in trouble for selling. Like I slide into the house hoping not to be noticed, and my dad and my sister are sitting on a couch. They have these stern looks on their faces for about a heartbeat, and then they burst out laughing. And my dad stands up, slaps me on the back, and says, "Dinner's on you." I do stand-up comedy. He always gives me about 45 minutes worth of notes at the end of every time he sees me do a show. Because everything is the sale to him. Everything is the sale. It doesn't matter if you're a storyteller or a stand-up comic or an actor, or if you're in banking. My father's like, everybody has a pitch, and he can help with the pitch. He says, "Okay, so the MC is your front man. He gets you into the house so that you can make the sale. Very important. You should never be introduced as being entertaining in any way. They should only talk about your credits. People should be wowed by what you've done. And then when you get on stage and you're entertaining, that is a bonus. When you end your show, never end on a joke." And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "You do your last joke, and then you got to do your post-close warm down. You've made the sale, right? Now let the people know that it was time well spent. Take a moment. Tell them what you told me, how much you love to perform. Ask them if they've had a good time. If they have, they should tell their friends to come out and see you. You can make a joke there. Tell them you need the work. That's funny. Thank them for coming out to the show." My dad is an excellent salesman, and I love performing. If you've had a good time hearing this story, please tell your friends. I need the work. Thanks a lot.
That's Jackie Cation. She's originally from Wisconsin, but she now lives and works here in Los Angeles as a comedian, writer, and actress. She's got a half-hour special on Comedy Central and a podcast called The Dork Forest. You can find a link at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, and we're calling this episode Your Future in Sales, three stories about the world of salesmanship. Next up is writer Dave White. He's been on a few episodes of this program before, and each time gives us a little peek into his complicated history and family life. And what we learn is usually both heartbreaking and hilarious. And in this story, young Dave White finds everyone at home embracing the sales game with a religious fervor. But for his part, Dave has trouble visualizing success. On KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Unfictional.
My mother and her sister have the same first name. Sort of. My mother's name is Joanna, and her older sister is named Atha Jo. Now, my mother calls my aunt Sis. And everybody else in the family calls my aunt Jo. Everybody else in the family also calls my mother Jo. Not Jo 1 and Jo 2, or Big Jo and Little Jo, just Jo and Jo. They were the Joes. In the spring of 1979, the Joes got an idea. Why not go to construction sites and scavenge the leftover materials? Then they could sell them to customers to use in their own repair and renovation projects, kind of like a proto-Home Depot for cast-off garbage. And they were convinced that there were plenty of other Roswellites just like us, the scrounging people who spent years waiting for just the right piece of jagged wood to come along to assist in propping up the sagging backyard deck, or a carpet square of an unrelated color to patch up a cigarette burn hole in the living room rug. Now, my parents, especially the Joes, who were kind of always thinking about a future full of rainy days, had lots of plans to turn our life, which was basically working-class poverty, into one of comfort and leisure, just like, you know, everybody else. Now, most of these plans never made it out of the dinner discussion phase, because at their core, my parents viewed money as a strange, unknowable force that they didn't quite understand. It was like magic paper that the wind would blow through their window, and all they had to do was be lucky, awake, or sober enough to hold up their money-catching nets when that exact moment came along. Joe and Joe's Construction Remnants opened on 3rd Street in Roswell, New Mexico. The store had no aisles, just mounds of material that were more or less alike. No prices, just handwritten signs indicating that each mound of crap was going to cost the customer somewhere between 10 cents and a couple of bucks. We spent the opening weekend organizing the mounds. The customers refused to join us. This went on for about 3 months. Then Joe and Joe's went out of business. My mom, who worked as a bank teller, took a second job at night as a cocktail waitress to keep us together. But then along came Amway. At my Aunt Jo's house, I began noticing strange cases of cleaning products in packaging unlike what you would find at the supermarket. One of her 4 adult sons had gotten involved with Amway and had convinced her and my Uncle BD to join him in the multi-level marketing business. Cases of vitamins arrived soon after. "It's better than that stuff you get at the store," said BD. "That one-a-day nonsense is for fools that want to throw their money away." Now, within a month, my mother and stepfather were using Amway products exclusively, buying wealth-related inspirational books with titles like Acres of Diamonds and motivational cassettes designed to help them envision giant piles of cash. A speaker whose name was Zig Ziglar was mentioned frequently, and some of his cassettes became staples in the car tape player. Thanks to the literature, or the tapes, or the example of my aunt, uncle, and cousin, my parents were encouraged to post photos ripped from magazines of the material fantasies they'd previously been too scared to talk about in public. And God was involved in all this somehow, but I couldn't figure out exactly how. All I knew was that my parents attended weeknight meetings in church clothes, and I was suddenly made witness to the embarrassment of all of their previously unspoken desires now posted on the refrigerator door and bathroom mirror. And my mother, who had already lived with one alcoholic husband and now was trying her hand at marriage to a second, was pragmatic, and she clipped pictures of jewelry, as you could sell that when times got hard, and she knew deep down they probably would. But my stepfather, who existed in a nearly constant Miller Lite haze, wanted a yacht. This seemed absolutely reasonable to him. That we lived in the middle of the New Mexico desert did not conflict with the certainty that his true calling involved shark fishing with Aristotle Onassis. My younger brother Matt, whom I could almost always count on to not only listen to, but share private mocking jokes at my parents' expense. He had hit puberty, he was now in high school with me, and he had one agenda, leaving the house to play basketball with his friends. He also surprisingly resisted my skepticism. "I'm going to put up a picture of a Trans Am," he told me. "You're not even participating in this," I said. "You're not doing anything. You have to be an Amway person to get this stuff. You can't just hop on the bandwagon without selling some vitamins." "We're the kids. We get whatever they get," he jabbed back at me. So my family's love affair with Amway lasted about a year, and I stayed mostly silent. Occasionally, I would ask one of the dozen questions that I held privately, but they were always met with weird non-answers. I didn't understand if it was simply a selling stuff company, like Avon or Tupperware, or if it was also about making other people get on board to sell the products too. And if you got all your friends to join the club, wouldn't they become your competition? And if everyone you knew was also an Amway, who would be left to hit up on when it was time for refills? And why did it also involve the feeling that my parents had joined a kind of new church? Our family of 4 washed our clothes with hundreds of scoops of SA8 detergent and washed our hair with the Amway shampoos. I kept friends out of the house so they wouldn't ask questions about why there was a picture of a gigantic yacht attached to our bathroom mirror. I spent a lot of time at my new after-school job as a supermarket bag boy or in my room listening to records. I had graduated from 12-inch disco singles to intense-looking bands that provoked baffled questions. "How do you have a rock group named Just Germs? That's disgusting. Who likes this noise besides you?" After a few rounds of that interrogation, I'd be left alone while my stepfather and BD and the Joes sat around a table with my aunt's main Amway son, RD, as he helped them fine-tune their pitch for potential converts. By the way, these are not privacy-related initials. Southern men just do this kind of thing. I also have a great uncle named C.H. No money rolled in. None. But at least the day-to-day tone of our home remained strangely upbeat. My stepfather even attempted sobriety for a few months. The money was coming soon, the acres of diamonds were nearing harvest time, yachts and furs and new cars were all right around the corner. Thanksgiving came, and my oldest brother Tim arrived. He was a first-year law student at the time, and he brought his wife Rebecca with him. I didn't warn them about possible sales pitches. They knew about the Amway takeover of our home, but they had never offered any opinion. I assumed Amway took Thanksgiving Day off, just like everybody else in the regular world, and for most of the morning and afternoon, I was right. It was just eating and football. Then, quietly, after not speaking to Tim, my cousin R.D. began asking him these open-ended questions about law school and about his future. What were Tim's goals? Did he think of himself as a results-oriented person? Did he have a vision for success? Is this about selling cleaning products? Asked my brother. Within minutes, a dogfight broke out. A battle of condescension and sarcasm reared its head, and it all turned ugly very, very fast. There was shouting. I don't need your pyramid scheme. In 3 years, I'll be a lawyer. But is that all you want to do with your life? Asked my cousin. My stepfather cracked open a beer, and the Joes sat by silently during this verbal storm where words like uneducated and gullible and God's will were tossed around. It didn't last long. Tim and Rebecca got their coats, they walked out the door, and they drove away. My stepfather, finally buzzed enough to pick on the last remaining near adult, spoke up. You know, Dave, if you came to a meeting with us, it'd be a good way to meet girls. I already know lots of girls, I said, attempting to be as quiet and non-animated as possible. I figured that maintaining a flat tone and a low volume would keep me out of it. I didn't know I was gay just yet, but I did know that the girl questions always made me feel like people were spying on my brain and discovering secrets I wasn't ready to divulge. And besides, I couldn't imagine any of my female friends in the same room with my parents for more than the time it took to say, we're off to see Porky's, be back late. But you don't date any of them. They're all just friends. If I didn't know any better, I'd think you were gay. I'm not interested. In girls? Asked my cousin R.D. No. Just in Amway. It's y'all's thing. I'm really busy with school. I have marching band practice every day. I have homework. I have my job at the grocery store. Amway just seems, I don't know, weird. That was a bad word choice. Are you calling us weird? No, I said, not weird. That's not what I mean. I'm just saying I don't want to do it. I have a job. It takes up all my time outside of school. Well, we're on the road to becoming rich now, continued my Uncle B.D. We visualize our success. We see it unfolding before us. Our acres of diamonds are waiting for us to collect them. But if you don't have any goals... My goal, I said, is to finish high school and go to college. Oh, so you think going to college is going to solve everything? You think it'll make you better than us? Yes, I thought. No, I sighed. I just want different things. Different things besides money? He asked. How will you pay for food? I'll do some Amway, said my brother Matt, who'd been silently smirking the entire time in my direction and occasionally kicking me under the table. I want a Trans Am. There are other jobs in the world, I said. I mean, I assumed there were. I'd never been to any other part of the world, but other people in other cities had to be living cooler, more interesting lives than this. I felt very powerful for a brief second, more in charge of myself than during any other shouting match I had ever had with my stepfather. I'll get one of those jobs with my college degree. I had no idea what I was talking about. I had heard those words spoken by a character on a TV show that I had forgotten, but they sounded right, and they sounded mean, which was what I was aiming for. With this, my stepfather slammed his empty beer bottle down on the table and stormed off to the living room. He closed the door with a loud thud. And moments later, my cousin went home My mother and my aunt washed the dishes. My uncle went next door to his house to smoke cigars and watch football. And my aunt left. My mother walked into the living room where my stepfather had already fallen asleep. And she watched TV with the sound down very low, leaving him there when she finally went off to bed. The next morning, when I woke up, he was still there, blacked out in his recliner, dreaming of a very big boat.
Dave White is the author of the memoir Exile in Guyville, and he writes for Movies.com, MSNBC.com, and Slake. He also co-hosts a movie podcast called Linoleum Knife. You can find links at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, and while you're there, you can become a fan of this show on Facebook. I'm Bob Carlson, and you're listening to Unfictional on KCRW and kcrw.com, and an episode called Your Future in Sales. We close the program with a quick story from Carrie Syme. She's a writer and an actress, and this is a story about the first time she ever had to engage in the particular kind of selling you do as an actress. Selling a character. Selling yourself. And at the age of 9, it was clear that Carrie was ready to commit to a role big time.
So a couple of years ago, I went back home to Bellevue, Nebraska to visit my parents. And I discovered, tucked away in their basement, my childhood filing cabinet. And I was digging through it, and I found a lot of writing from elementary school, middle school, high school. But the thing that kind of caught my eye the most was the first monologue that I ever wrote, which I wrote in fourth grade. And it's all scribbled and scratched, and I've lots of underlining passionately, and it's covered in all colors of ink. The backstory on it is that when I was in fourth grade, my tiny community theater, which is called the Bellevue Little Theater, was staging a heartwarming, nostalgic version of A Christmas Carol. And the thing that I wanted most in the world was to get cast in that show and to get famous, even though I'd never auditioned for anything before. So I convinced my mom to let me audition. And there are three things that you need to know about 9-year-old me. Number one is that I was a bookworm, and I especially loved dark and mysterious books like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and that type of thing. And the second thing you need to know is that I was quite a girly girl, so there was a lot of pink going on, a lot of dresses, skirts, ruffles. It was like owning my femininity from a very young age. And the third thing that you need to know is that I was a bit of a high achiever. I was really ambitious. So while all the other children and adults auditioning at this little community theater just read from the script that was provided at the audition, I wrote my own monologue. I just want you to imagine this sweet little 9-year-old me wearing an adorable pink dress, just giving it my all for this tender, angelic Christmas play. My name is Dr. John Edwin. Strange? You may call it strange that I'm a doctor, but it should only prove to you that my story is all true. I had been finishing an autopsy of an old patient. His name was Henry Shepherd. Last year, he and I got into a dispute. He claims I prescribed him the wrong medication for his hand-shaking problem. He claims it made his hands shake more. But the thing that hurts me most is that my dear friend Henry claims I did it on purpose. Now, my friends, I leave it to you. Why would a dear old friend do something like that? I might have made a mistake in the prescription, but on purpose? Ridiculous! I'm just going to step away from the monologue right now and point out that it is written on this spectacular 1980s notebook paper that has a rainbow and a sunshine, and on the sunshine is a smiley face. Okay, so back into the monologue. On October 31, the phone rang. It was Henry's lawyer. I was still the prime benefactor of Henry's $2,700 fortune. Huh. But I wouldn't have accepted it. I was fuming with anger. My hands trembled with violence. I was going to scream horrible words to that lawyer. But my brilliant mind was thinking ahead of my body. And then at this point in the monologue, this paragraph, I have no idea what happened. I did my business. It was like any normal day. At 3 o'clock, I went down to the basement to get my gold silverware set. And then we just jump back into the regular theme of the monologue. It was an eerie night. The spirits were upon me. I finally came to Henry's home. The maid answered the door. I noticed her telling a cook she was leaving on a 2-week vacation. I also think I was watching a lot of the movie Clue at this point in my life, just as a heads up. Henry didn't notice me. I said, "Goodbye, Henry." His body quickly hurled himself around. Our eyes met and locked for a second. I was merely a puppet being toyed with in a tragedy. My hand lunged into Henry's stomach. He did not flinch nor scream. He was not surprised. He knew the plot well. He simply fell limply to the floor and then stiffened. He died with a look of pain on his face. It disgusted me then, and it still does now. The next morning, I felt refreshed. I thought everyone would understand if I explained it to them. Later in the morning, I had another thought. Most people are pretty insensitive. I thought perhaps it would be better to keep quiet. I wouldn't even have been involved in the autopsy if another doctor, Terry Hall, hadn't found something slightly peculiar in Henry Shepherd's body. It was an object, and Terry guessed it was metal. Any ordinary doctor would have let it go. But Terry was curious, a little too curious. Terry told me that the piece of gold in Henry's body was a very unusual kind. It had a certain kind of lead base that was only made for 1 year in Mexico, which makes it a collector's item. And then he had the idiotic nerve to tell me it reminded him of some gold silverware set he had seen. And then I gave him my big laugh. Terry is now dead. That's why I'm hiding. The play is only at intermission and will continue someday with the characters changing. Thank you.
Carrie Syme is an alumni of the Groundlings Comedy Theater. Her essay, Outsourcing Love, about hiring a virtual assistant in India to manage her love life, was recently optioned by Billy Crystal for a feature film. You can find more information about her, including some really great photos of young Carrie and her monologue, at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. It's a part of KCRW's independent producer project. The editor of the program is Jacob Conrad. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support of the independent producer project and Unfictional. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And while you're there, you can leave a comment and become a fan of the program on Facebook. You can podcast the show either at the website or at iTunes, or listen on demand with one of KCRW's smartphone apps. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it or leave a review on iTunes. I'm Bob Carlson. All Things Considered from NPR is coming up next. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com.